there was a Starbucks and I could get my iced coffee and then sit down and have an iced coffee and a cigarette.
Was the iced bit important?
Yes, I was feeling very bisexual at that point. So I don't think I'll go to Games Expo again without a lot of planning.
Oh, did you not have much fun?
It was fun. And I got a game I've been after for ages, which I was very pleased with. But it was really, really fucking crowded. So like you couldn't really stop, and some of the booths there was some space too, but a lot of them like you just couldn't really stop and like linger and chat and look at things because the crowds are kind of nudging you along. And they had like loads of tables where you could sit and play games, but the people I was with didn't really want to like stop and sit and play a game. They wanted to keep walking around these huge trade halls and look at stuff. And eventually there was like a secondhand bit, like a bring and buy, which is I wanted to go to. You had to queue for like half an hour, 20 minutes to like get into it because it was a limited space. So I went like with the sole aim of I want the Guards Discworld game.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's out of print. And I walked in, it was on the first table as I walked in.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, amazing. It's there. Picked it up. That is going to be my game now. I'll buy that. But yeah, it was just eventually I hit a wall of like, and we have to leave now. There's two people. And if I don't get an iced coffee into me, I might die.
So did you get the game?
I did get the game.
Okay. Do we have any Discworldian news? Well, I suppose we haven't talked about the Good Omens trailer in an episode.
Good Omens Season 2 trailer came out. Naked John Hamm.
Need we say more?
Yeah.
Probably not, but we will. I haven't rewatched it and done the frame by frame thing yet. I'm actually probably going to for this because I could spot the odd bit where I was like, oh, there's probably an Easter egg there. But we live reacted to it for a fairly amateurish live react video. I never understand how YouTube people managed it. I said amateurish on my part. You kept your face doing expressions the whole time. I rewatched it like, do I just look like that all the time? No wonder people think I'm angry. I don't know how the YouTube people like keep it up for like full, you know, 5-6 minute reaction videos.
Well, it's very rarely a live react to the first thing. I'm assuming most people actually watch it first, plan that's their reactions and do it accordingly. So I'm blowing this whole thing wide open.
Yeah, no, that's what else the fuck is happening. That's probably about all the happenings I can think of.
I can't think of anything major in Discworldy. It's nearly my birthday.
It is nearly your birthday. Yay. Do you know what you're doing Saturday yet?
I'm meeting you for coffee and then I'm going to the pub.
Yeah, we've got a little heat wave coming up as well. Your birthday just in time.
We have. I'm very pleased. I'm going to be barbecuing again on Sunday with my shiny new barbecue.
Ooh, how did barbecue the first go after you? Did you eventually get it alight? Joanna was having some problems with conflagration.
I'm weirdly bad at lighting barbecues, which is, you know, I'm good at other types of fire, just barbecues.
What you want is one of these
chimney starter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I ordered one on Amazon today. It'll be here in time for barbecuing this weekend.
Yeah, I need to order a new one because I left ours outside in the winter and it's rusted.
That is what I'm getting myself. But despite that, the chicken did cook perfectly and was absolutely delicious.
Lovely. Glad to hear it. Do you know what you're cooking in it on Sunday?
I'm going to do some pork belly, but over an indirect heat for a while. So it all cooks nice and slowly and lovely with a delicious sauce on it.
Mm.
And I'll roast some peppers and chilies on there and make a little charred corn salsa with those. And I'm going to do some new potato and chorizo skewers and
excellent
whatever else in the fridge that needs using up.
Judging by how hot it's going to be, probably going to put some pesto in some pasta. Oh, I haven't had dinner yet. We probably should stop talking about food eventually. I'm not that hungry, luckily. But
no, I had a really big omelette for lunch so that I wouldn't get peckish while recording. Love an omelette. I don't have enough omelettes in my life.
I was talking about omelettes with Jack just a second. I was saying that if you say your signature dish is an omelette, you have to be known as a really good cook already. Otherwise, it just sounds like you're saying, I can't cook. You know what I mean? So like if a master whittler specializes in wooden spoons, then you know that's going to be like the best wooden spoon, whatever. But if like I said, yeah, I know, I whittle, I can do wooden spoons. You can tell I've only gotten up to that.
Yeah.
I don't know how hard spoons are.
Well, depends on the wood. Whittle them. Jesus.
Oh, Joe, can we just make a fucking podcast?
Would you like to make a podcast, Francine?
I would like to make a podcast.
Let's talk
about nonsense as long as you let me. I'm sorry.
Let's make a podcast. Hello and welcome to The True Show Make You Fret, a podcast in which we're reading and recapping every book from Terry Pratchett's Discworld series one at a time in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And this is part two of our discussion of The Science of Discworld, volume two, The Glob.
The Pagloib.
The Pagloib.
The Glib.
The Glib. We are taking
Wow, giving up before I'm starting. What a good day.
We're taking our work very seriously here on The Truth Shall Make You Fret. Note on spoilers before we crack on. We're a spoiler-light podcast, heavy spoilers for The Science of Discworld Volume 2, The Pagloib. But we will avoid spoiling any major future events in the Discworld past A Hatful of Sky, which is where we're up to in the current canon. And we are, of course, saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld novel, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there, so you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us.
Thing, stage left, pursued by a horseshoe.
Follow-up.
We have some.
We asked if any of you had experiences of corporate away days, and no paintball, but definitely some away days.
Yes, very, very sorry to bring up these memories.
Craig's email, I particularly want to highlight the line, some days felt like fingernails were being extracted without anaesthetic, the rest were worse.
Ooh.
But no paintball.
Oh, good.
Space Alex has never done corporate paintball or any kind of paintball, but has stories of scientists doing bonding activities.
Okay.
They used to do something called Dr. John's Pizza Party in the park, which was awkward frisbee followed by pizza. One Christmas, they all went to the supervisor's apartment and had a gingerbread building competition, master students versus PhDs versus postdocs. And the master students lost quite badly, which is embarrassing for me, who has an engineering degree.
Yeah.
And I love this. I should also mention, anytime my lab goes anywhere, we invariably see the sky doing something, like sundogs, halos and rainbows, and then get distracted for a bit, staring up near the sun and taking photos.
Staring at the sun. A fun corporate bonding activity. You heard it here first.
Absolutely.
Near the sun. I'm sure they were very careful to say.
And Pete from Patreon, also no paintball, but firing arrows from a bow at a target.
Close.
Yeah, I think that's the closest we've had
depending
to paintball.
Depending on the target.
Well, wait, how depending on the target?
What? Well, I'm thinking, do you remember that scene in the Disney's Robin Hood where they all have paint on the end of their arrows?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There were
Wait,
quad
is that
bikes.
From Robin Hood or something else?
Well, now
I'm thinking of the song Princess.
I just went along with it.
I'm sorry.
I remembered arrows in Robin Hood and assumed you were right. From Sherwood Forest and Nottingham. Sorry. There were also quad bikes and things all at the behest of Branson when he was contract programming at Virgin Mobile.
Oh.
I went through a brief phase while working on the book of being like mildly obsessed with Richard Branson. So I respect that.
Why has he been in the news? Oh, the space thing went bankrupt, didn't it?
Yeah. But like, as billionaires go, he seems to not be the worst.
Well, that's a low bar.
Yeah, true. We've got anything else?
Yeah, we've had a really fantastic email from Peter, who has sent us a PDF of a 17th century bestiary, which, as he put it, beautifully demonstrates a moment of time when scientific rationality was struggling to be birthed out of superstitious assumptions, which is what we're talking about in these two books.
It is.
In these two parts of this one book. He has very kindly sent us a PDF of this wonderful, weird bestiary, which includes chimeras such as the manticore. Our friend the manticore, as Pete has captioned it, is possibly the worst thing I've ever seen. I love it. And he did highlight the fact that there's a very Agnes Nutter-esque title, which we all know I love, The History of Four-Footed Beasts, giving into temptation today, and serpents, describing at large their true and lively figure, their several names, conditions, kinds, virtues, brackets, both natural and medicinal, countries of their breed, their love and hatred to mankind, and the wonderful work of God in their creation, preservation, and destruction.
Jesus.
It goes on for a while.
Anyway, it's one of the best things we've ever been sent. I had a quick skim through it earlier, and there's some haunting shit in there, lads. The giraffes are drawn.
I'm surprised you looked at the drafts. Usually you refuse to believe that they exist.
Yeah, well, it's also got manticores and unicorns in it, Francine. I'm not going to be the one to judge what's real and what's not in
yeah,
that
fair.
Case.
Absolutely fair.
Right. Enough fucking about. Should we talk about the book?
I guess.
Francine, do you want to tell us what happened previously on The Science of Discworld Volume 2?
Yes, certainly. Previously on Science of Discworld 2, Merry Christmas.
Jesus.
Wizards war in the name of peace, but their corporate conflict is cut short by a frosty intrusion. Luckily, old Seven Buckets Rincewind is hanging around, ready to receive a message in a bottle from his castaway colleagues, and learns that they're stranded in an elf-infested world that just happens to live in his office. Which means that, aha, there are numerous elves on his shelf. Reluctant Rincewind and a wary librarian are chivied through L space and onto Roundworld to save the faculty from whatever nonsense they've gotten themselves into this time. They arrive, find Hex in a crystal ball, and track down the rest of the faculty in a local tavern, of course. Now it's time for meddling. A bit of time travel leads to cultural catastrophe, and a bit more time travel, with a pause for alter ego death, sorts things more or less out. But just as the wizards relax, the chill returns. What happens next?
In this section, which goes from chapter 17 to the end, we're not saving the last chapter for a different episode or anything weird like that. The Queen visits the wizards, laying claim to Roundworld and warning off the wizards. Ridcully has an idea and sends a clax to Mistress Weatherwax in Lanka. Granny's gathering wood amidst interruptions. A Shornog delivers a clax and she sends a single word reply. The wizards expect the collapse of civilization in a century, but they've got time to read the clacks. Granny's advised them to change the story. Librarian digs out some books from different futures. The wizards study a few examples of science, but they're stumped at equine experimentations. Back at Dee's, they decide to leave well enough alone. Rincewind and the librarian watch an awful play in the distant company of elves. Rincewind suggests that the wizards focus on the arts, exacerbating the effect of the elves to end them. Back in time, Rincewind teaches the magic inherent in art throughout history, and the Queen isn't happy. When Rincewind's teaching actors in Greece, the Queen arrives to question his actions. She plunges the depths of his desire to find potatoes, but claims an as-yet unwritten Shakespeare script from his hands. Back in Dee's time, art has developed. In stage two of The Plan, Rincewind explains seeing as a lack of believing. There's no gods here by the look of it, but history's adapted to make Shakespeare happen. The elves are pleased with the play and don't see the harm in humanity growing questions. The wizards give Will Shakespeare an idea, and after a heavy night, they wake to find the play complete. At the theatre, Rincewind's backstage to make sure that the show goes on. The Queen attempts to interrupt, but the librarian takes her out. With humanity back on track to eventually get off the planet, the wizards head home through Elspace.
Hey. Huzzah.
So, helicopters and loincloths.
Any?
Well, we meet briefly Da Vinci, and he learns about that flying machine, what Leonard of Gwern built, which I feel is not obvious helicopter, but I want to give honourable mention to George Cayley designing an aircraft that would have flown if the internal combustion engine had been invented.
Yes. We also have Archimedes' screw, I suppose, could. It turns.
It does turn. Yeah, no, honorary helicopter. But
we so rarely get anything that even slightly resembles one.
We'll throw in as many as we can. Archimedes' screw just sounds a bit dirty, though, doesn't it?
It would be a great cocktail name.
Oh, the Archimedes' screw. All right, well,
we should come up with a bunch of philosophy cocktail names.
Yes, and then I'll come up with the cocktails.
Yes.
And then I'll die.
All right.
Well, I've got a taste test then.
Oh, I see.
that wasn't like random existentialism. That was specific alcohol-based existentialism.
Good.
As far as loincloths go, I'm going to say Burnt Stick Man definitely has a loincloth vibe.
Mm.
So he gets that. And we learn that elephants do paintings and sign them.
We do. So last week I talked about the kind of Elephant Voices website that I've spoken about a few times, and I don't think I've ever explained what I mean properly. So I've actually got the description up here. The Elephant Ethogram is a uniquely detailed catalogue or library, like so we'll do some library, I'm tying it in, of the behaviour and communication of African span elephants, based on decades of behavioural studies, photographs, audio video recordings, lots of professional amateur footage. You can go through it, all of this stuff. It's very, very cool. I'll link to the proper tool and everything. Also mentioning it because I think the subtitle Navigating the Elephant Ethogram would be a great album name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
That's it.
Amazing. So, quotes. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, it's quite long.
That's all right. That's what she said. I'm sorry.
We already got spoon jokes in. Do you know what? We didn't do any real spoon jokes. We just went straight for the wood. Huh. That's what she, sorry. Oh, God, I'm the worst.
This is a grown-up, sensible podcast, Francine. What's your quote?
Oh, no. Why didn't you tell me before? This is episode 118.
Yeah, I should have probably mentioned that. Right, what's your quote?
Great Antigonus is wrong. I proved him wrong, not by thoughtful dispute, but by gross mechanical contrivances. I am ashamed. He is the greatest of all philosophers. He had told us that the sun goes around the world. He had told us how the planets move. And if he is wrong, what is right? What have I done? I've squandered the wealth of my family. What fame is there for me now? What cursed work should I do next? Should I steal the colours from a flower? Shall I say to everyone, what you think is right is not right? Shall I weigh the stars? Shall I plumb the utter depths of the sea? Shall I ask the poet to measure the width of love and the direction of pleasure? What have I made of myself? And he wept. Which I just think is so fucking dramatic. I love it.
Right.
One day, I'm going to memorize that and look like I'm also cuffing it to somebody when I prove them wrong.
Amazing.
How
Please
about you?
Do it over the most minor thing possible.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
Mine is an elf chat. Mm. And would you wish to be called Peas Blossom? The eyes of the old elf were grey, flecked with silver. They had seen horrible things under many suns, and in most cases had enjoyed them. Humans were a valuable crop, the elf conceded. There had never been a species like it for depth of awe, terror, and superstition. No other species could create such monsters in its heads. But sometimes, it considered, they were not worth the effort. I think not, it said. It's like the idea of, yes, no, these are great and terrible, but fucking Peas Blossom. Anyway, characters. Granny Weatherwax gets a little moment.
Yeah, a little witchy cameo.
Nice to see a bit of Granny.
My favourite reluctant narrative imperative.
I love the bit about the wood gathering. Wood gathering was a task fraught with danger for an old lady so attractive to narrativium.
Yes.
It was quite hard these days when gathering firewood to avoid third sons of kings, young swineherds seeking their destiny, and others whose unfolding adventure demanded they be kind to an old lady.
Fantastic. It's got nice echoes of when we first heard about Lanka and said, if there's no omens going on, that's weird. That's an omen.
Yeah. And in, I think it's in Weird Sisters as well, where they all play old ladies gathering wood.
Oh, yeah.
Lorks, me feet.
Oh, yes, lorks.
To get themselves picked up. Lorks, dearie me, young children aren't what they used to be.
And then we have our favourite Lanka civil servant, because he's the only one, but I think he'd be our favourite anyway.
I've got a lot of time for Shornog. I'm a big fan.
He's a hard worker. He's a grafter, not a grifter.
He is. Handles everything from national defence and tax gathering to mowing the castle lawns, although he's allowed help with the lawns.
Yes. I imagine it'd be very difficult to get a lawn in Lanka.
Well, yeah, it's all at an angle.
Yeah.
Is it still a lawn if it's at 70 degrees?
Good question. Gardeners. Answers on a face card.
How angled are your lawns? Again, asking the big, hard-hitting questions here on The Truth Shall Make You Fret.
Absolutely. Skimming right over the philosophy and existential crises today.
Yep. Big questions. Angled lawns.
Other characters? We have
Nicholas the Cretan, Phocion the Touched, and, of course, the philosopher Antigonus. I like this whole bit with the experiment about the horses trotting.
Hmm. Dragged on a bit, but yes.
It did drag on a bit, and honestly, I let some of it kind of wash over me. I'm not going to lie. But I spent a lot of time looking at the gaits of horses and how their feet move when they're, like, walking and running when I was little, because I spent a lot of time drawing and was around horses a lot, so I spent a lot of time drawing horses and trying to work out what the fuck their legs were doing.
Yeah, the horses are notoriously difficult to draw.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't draw horses well.
Yeah.
I was better at flowers.
Yeah, the horse physiology is, like, really notorious among artists. Just yeah, it's just, it doesn't make any sense.
What the fuck are they doing?
I think, yeah, you need to go right down to the anatomy for it and then build up from there. It's fucking horrible. I can't draw a horse for shit.
My mother took me to see lots of famous paintings of horses to help me try and understand what was happening.
Yeah. Because I did a part of a college course on graphic design and shit like that. I did all, like, the history of film during that. So the horse the horse trotting problem I was very familiar with already, because that was like one of the first uses of high speed photography, which yeah
working out what the horse's feet were doing.
Yes, I can't remember the answer.
It is, I think it's explained in the book, it is, they are all off the ground at some point.
Yeah. I like, don't the, ask the whole bit about the voicemail, that was pretty cool. The entire,
oh yeah, the whole bit that he sort of keeps inventing technology that could do other really amazing things.
Yeah, yeah, and
just to figure out this
one
problem.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like there's this one set of TikToks. I can't remember who it is now, but it's like some guy saying like, "Oh, I found a cure for orphans." And the other guy's like, "What?" And he's like, "Yeah, I've made it so like people's parents will never die, so no one will never be an orphan." And he's like, "Invented immortality. Oh, yeah, lead with that." And there's a whole series of them. It's great.
I like that. But yeah, it's quite cool seeing the kind of reflection of the philosopher mentor student kind of dynamic you get in your ancient Greek history.
What's it?
Which I don't think we covered in any of the previous Discworldian jaunts to ancient Greek parallels. Yeah, yeah.
I also quite like right at the end of that chapter, just after your quote, Nicholas says to the wizards, "No one comes now. This is where the fates struck and the gods laughed at men. But I remember how he wept, and so I remained to tell the story." And there's something about that and the fact that it's the beach and all these kind of slightly broken, falling apart, looted devices has a bit of an Ozymandias vibe to it.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So as that's my favourite poem, I'm going to find an Ozymandias vibe wherever there is one.
Mm. Although I don't think Ozymandias was on a beach. You might be thinking of Lost.
No, there was just a lot of sand around.
Yeah.
Beaches have sand. Ozymandias it's true. Also they do. Sandy.
They do. And we got a little reference to things on the edges again, which you enjoy.
We do like the edgy what's-its.
We got Ponder.
Ponder's having a rough time. Poor Ponder. With his good speaking voice.
He generally does, yeah.
He does. We have a lot of poor Ponder in this, even though he's a bit of a knob. But yeah, when he gets the play taken away from him, even though he thinks he's got quite a good voice after he got to play part of the third goblin in a school play.
It's the PowerPoint all over again.
He just doesn't get to finish things. And then when he gets really emotional about being in a world that actually works on logic.
Mm.
And it's a nice sort of reflection back to him at the end of Lords and Ladies, when he's trying to work out how the sort of iron attractive stones work, and he's just sitting there getting quite upset by it.
Fucking magnets. And then going right back to the, you know, it used to be Rincewind's little quirk, didn't it, that he'd be like,
oh, I thought there'd be some organized,
if only it wasn't magic.
Yeah. What if it all works
through... he's seen enough now, he can't be bothered with the ifs and buts and whatever.
Speaking of Rincewind,
he's had a good one, actually. He's done well.
He's done very well. He was the one who came up with the thing and it all worked, and he had to do some running away, but not much compared to the amount of running away he usually has to do.
Yeah, absolutely. The making use of his extreme talent for potatoes.
Which I respect as a deep lover of potatoes, and honestly, Rincewind thinking about potatoes was some of my favourite bits.
Agreed. Do you have any particular Rincewind potato moment that...
Well, I like that he points out that no one ever really gets potato croquettes right, because he's right there. They don't. They're always a little bit too soggy or slightly too greasy.
Yeah, sure.
Do you have a favourite way to eat potatoes?
No.
Well, I thought that would open up for more conversation than
we've
it did, to be honest.
We've had this discussion on the podcast. We've gone through like our top three potato things, I think, and I literally can't remember what I said my favourite one was. Today, I'm going to say it would be just... good, crunchy, crispy fries, I think. How about you?
I like that. It's always Dauphinois for me.
Yeah.
I want to cover things in cream and garlic and bake them.
Yeah, that's true. You do that a lot.
Not just potatoes.
No. That poor seagull.
Jesus. I haven't really noted any locations for us. I mean, we do go places.
No, I noticed that, yeah.
But,
that's fine, whatever. Oh, we just talked about the beach. What more do they want?
We had a bit of ancient Greece vibes. We had, obviously... that London,
yeah,
with a bit of a globe in it. I do like the Globe Theatre.
Head spikes, webs,
head spikes, big theatre. Yeah.
I like the Globe. Did you know that the thatch on the Globe was done by the same company who did the thatch for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves?
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a delightful
fact. Two biggest contracts, unsurprisingly. Prince of Thieves was a bigger one.
Well, there was a lot of Thatch in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yeah, I never really thought about it being like a custom-made set like that, but I guess, yeah. What a fucking high-budget movie.
God, I love that movie. It's awful.
I finally saw it.
It's awful, isn't it?
Yeah, I loved it. I like Alan Rickman.
Oh, yeah, I can watch him do anything. But yeah, listeners, if you ever get to be in London, go see something at the Globe. It's still cheap to be a groundling.
Yeah, I've never seen anything at Globe, actually.
I still think...
Is there a mosh pit if you're standing there?
Not quite mosh pit, but when I saw Amelia there, it was a bit like everyone shouting in feminist uproar, which was quite a nice communal experience. I saw King Lear there, and a thunderstorm started during the thunderstorm scene. I got soaked, but it was totally worth it.
Absolutely. What do you think the best Shakespeare moment to start a mosh pit would be?
Ooh. I don't know.
Do you want to think about it while we make a coffee?
Yeah, let's make a coffee. Okay. Romeo and Juliet death scene. Perfect time for a mosh pit.
Oh, nice. Yeah, perfect.
Do you remember that really good production of Twelfth Night we went to that was like completely irreverent and they ended up with like the front two rows on the stage conga dancing?
At Theatre Royal?
Yeah.
Yes.
That was a good one. I liked that.
I'm not sure I've seen Shakespeare performed outside. I keep saying I'll go to the Abbey for it and I never do.
Don't.
Okay. Thank you.
I didn't say that, but don't.
Okay. To be honest, I probably wasn't going to anyway, but now I have a reason, which is you saying no, and I don't even need any explanation. I'm that happy with the answer. So
we'll go to the Globe at some point. We'll okay. See something there. We'll go to the Globe.
The Globe. But it's on at the Globe. Sorry, no, fuck.
Right, we're making a fucking podcast, Francine.
It's not even Friday. I keep thinking, it's fine, it's Friday. I've got to work tomorrow.
Thank you for doing this a day early so I can go out for dinner tomorrow.
Oh, no, you're fine. Now I got a random Friday night. What am I going to do?
You're going to eat pasta and watch telly, I'm sure.
I'm absolutely going to do that, yeah.
I do not mean that in a derogatory way.
No.
Anyway, right.
Sorry.
We are making a fucking podcast.
Fine.
So, little bits we liked. What did you like, Francine?
So, the theatre bit, which you mentioned in your summary, Granny Weatherwax managed to have a one-word reply to the extremely long question by the wizards. First of all, it's quite fun because the clue was the change the story, and it was an anagram of the story. And as anybody who has spent as much time in the pub while people do cryptic crosswords around us as we have will know, there are loads of ways you can indicate an anagram within a cryptic crossword. And I found a list that is so fucking long, it completely justifies my annoyance with the entire subject. Like, oh my God, Joanna, I'll link it in the thing, but it's incredibly long. Basically, fucking anything you could imagine that might mean mixed up or like scrambled, whatever, could mean an anagram. Slightly more interestingly to me was the stuff about trying to get a clax very short because it's per letter, it's charged per letter, as were the telegrams in our reality. And I'm not going to go into detail about it much because we're going to talk about telegrams at length in a few months, I think. At length, which would be expensive if we were doing it by telegram, but we're not because it's a podcast. That's weird.
Telegram podcast.
But I just found some cool articles about how people used to, especially people who needed to know a lot of stuff about business, used to kind of make up codes to get a lot of information across in one. So there's like this 200 page codex with translations from things like, so the word amethyst would mean shall sail brackets or start from New York per right. It's like all of that, and it's like I don't think I had a bit of a look through it, and I don't think there's any like rhyme or reason to it.
That just came to mean certain things.
So you both need a copy of this codex, and as long as you both do, and you're very, there's a whole bit at the beginning about being very careful to make all the letters very clear as you're writing out your telegram. And I guess it really matters if you accidentally put the wrong word in and tank the stocks in New York.
Amazing.
Which reminds me of what three words is a concept, actually, now I think about it. Because if you get one of the words, that navigational tool.
Yeah.
If you get one of the words wrong, you can end up like hundreds of miles from where you went to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's that. That's
I did enjoy getting both the like thorough explanation of how the wizards are hacking the Grand Trunk and the actual explanation of how the round world equivalent of Clax works, especially for things like sending pictures, because I started looking at that with Monstrous Regiment, but this was a much clearer explanation of how the picture sendings work.
Yeah. Did this book reference the book The Victorian Internet?
No, I don't think it did.
That's meant to be very good. I think I've seen Pratchett recommend that on the forum, so we'll have to try and get ourselves a copy of that before we do the episodes on it.
Yes, I think that was one of his big research ones.
Cool and good. What's yours?
Scientific defamiliarization. I just like the idea of, you know, I get excited when we do the defamiliarization thing, especially now I can remember the fucking word. And not that thing, where it's kind of like that thing, but not like that thing, so we see that thing differently.
Definitely not an allegory, I'll tell you that.
Probably not an allegory. So yeah, seeing
that's
science.
Water, I think. Sorry.
Seeing science from the wizard's perspective with this kind of a, what the fuck is this, as a way to push in this, how does one define what science is, was enjoyable to me. I like that as going into a bit of a philosophical concept.
I did. I enjoyed the bit where Pratchett explained it.
Yes. Pratchett explained it best.
I then didn't so much enjoy the 20 pages of doing the same thing. And I didn't dislike this half of the book as much as I did the first half. I don't know if it was the mood I'm in, or as I said, I got it off my chest last week, or just the subjects that are being covered were less irritating to me. But again, there was quite a lot of editing could have been done.
Yeah, I enjoyed this half more, but I think that's partly because I allowed myself to not get too bogged down in detail.
Yeah.
One detail I did get really into, though, is this line about the Wine Dark Sea.
Ah, yes, one of our favourites.
Which gets repeated when they're in multiple times when they're anywhere a bit ancient Greek.
Yeah.
So I know it's from Homer. It's used in the Iliad and the Odyssey multiple times, but I hadn't looked into sort of anything behind it. And it's really interesting. And this could have honestly taken up a lot more of my time and gone down a big rabbit hole, but I was trying to be good. So it's a traditional English translation of a specific phrase that's used multiple times in the Iliad and the Odyssey. It's not necessarily exactly what it means. It might, because obviously it's being translated from ancient Greek, the sort of prevailing theory is that more properly it's something like wine-eyed. So there's this guy, William Gladstone, who was a 19th century British politician and scholar who, in an analysis...
This guy called William Gladstone. Sorry.
This guy called William Gladstone. Quite famous. Might have heard of him. In an analysis of Homer's works, he found that there was an absence of any references to the colour blue. There was a word that came to mean blue in more modern Greek, but almost certainly meant dark at the time. Mm-hmm. And he proposed that Homeric use of words describing colours focused on how dark or light colours were rather than the hue of the colours, which created this massive public misconception that he meant ancient Greeks couldn't see certain colours.
Yeah.
Like, which has persisted to modern day.
Yeah.
But what was interesting as well, in generic usage, that this phrase that translates to kind of wine dark seemed to, especially in poetic stuff, refer to drunkenness or an abandonment due to alcohol, and therefore came to mean violent. So a wine dark sea is a violent, angry sea. It's a rough sea.
Oh, like somebody's eyes darkened, that kind of thing.
No, more like someone gets wine dark means that someone is drunk and therefore they're more likely to be aggressive.
Okay. Oh, great. Specifically. Yeah. Okay.
So then it comes to mean aggressive and therefore a wine dark sea is an aggressive sea. And yeah, so a whole rabbit hole to go down of linguistic relativity and colour naming. And how names of colours develop in different languages.
Ah.
Linguistic relativity and colour naming. I'm going to obsess over that for the next year.
Well, I've got many books on colour theory if you want that.
Excellent. What about you?
We've got Tame Surmise, which I just thought was fun. The idea that a tame surmise is a wild surmise after you've thought about it for a bit.
I like that.
Similarly, I put down anti-anti, which is a fun bit of etymology where anti can be close to, and I liked the way they explained it, which is, well, if you think about it, you know, the other side of the coin's right next to it, and we like our opposites not being opposites.
Yeah. And against
and absence not being absence of. Yeah.
Yes. Against can mean against or can mean up against. We get a bit about wizards giving Shakespeare ideas, which amused me because, you know, I like pointing out the little references. You told him about those witches up in Lancre and how they got the new king on the throne, which is obviously Macbeth, and the elves breaking through. How the Selakai and the Venturi families are always fighting. Which is great that they took the names of the two families named for West Side Story that was based on Romeo and Juliet, and then put it back around.
That's a much more winding reference than I thought, yeah.
It's like a circular reference.
Yeah, I love that.
And then getting worried that when they read it's the little song that the fairies sing while they're looking after Titania, cobweb and peas blossom and mustard seed. You spotted snakes with double tongues, thorny hedgehogs be not seen, and they're very worried that someone sang Shakespeare the hedgehog song.
Was that the actual lines from that song? I forgot to look it up.
Yeah, you spotted snakes with double tongues, thorny hedgehogs be not seen, snakes and blind worms do no wrong, come not near our fairy queen.
Cool. So I think we should probably rewrite the hedgehog never be buggered in iambic pentameter.
I rewrote a whole speech from episode 9 of Succession in iambic pentameter the other day.
We have fun. Yeah.
I did not have time to be fucking doing that. Cool. Information versus meaning then, Francie.
Information versus meaning. So I'm not really scientifically minded enough to discuss it in quite the way that the authors discussed this with the two different types of information and quantification and qualification and all of that, but I think it's an interesting topic anyway. So as the authors put it, is information the same as a story? No, a story does convey information, but that's probably the least interesting thing about stories. Most information doesn't constitute a story. So that's nicely tying it back into stories, I think. So they use the example of a telephone directory, lots of information, strong cast, a bit weak on the narrative. As a little point there, it's interesting, as we noted last week, how many little technological bits now look outdated already, even though it's 20 years ago, whatever it is, like referencing a telephone directory. I suppose you could still do that now, but we're getting to the point where that's a odd thing to reference.
I was thinking about that the other day, because it used to be if you were talking about someone having a particularly attractive voice, you'd say something along the lines of, oh, I'd listen to them read the phone book.
Yeah. Ooh, what would we say now, do we think?
I'd listen to them read a Wikipedia article on the origins of crosshead screwdrivers.
Perfect. Love that. I was going to say I'd listen to them read a Twitter for You page, but actually I absolutely would not. Doesn't matter. Absolutely unhinged. What the fuck was I talking about? Sorry,
phone
yes.
Books,
what counts
narrative.
In a story is meaning. And that's a very different concept from information. And that started me off thinking about, well, I also talk about context, and that's what gives information meaning a lot of the time, kind of a shared context. It kind of harkens back to one of our favorite subjects of nuclear semiotics, of course, where the point is to try and account for an unknowable context and therefore turn what wouldn't be a message into a message.
Yeah.
But Joanna, is it a message if it has intent, even if you can't supply the context? Is it still a message, just a failed one?
Yeah, I would say it's still a message. It's still information. Yeah. I don't think it has to be received to become a message or information.
Well, that's it. The point is, it is information, but when does it become a message? That was a bit of this chapter, yeah. And that's the context bit. But I think if it's with intent,
yeah,
it can be a failed message rather than just a random bit of information.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah.
Okay, good. And then on the other side of that coin, we have the tree rings, as they meant. I liked this old chapter, actually. We've learned to decode their message about climate and the like. Sixth ring indicates good year with lots of growth on the tree. But the sequence of tree rings only becomes a message, only conveys information when we figured out the rules that link climate to tree growth. The tree didn't send its message to us. And in that case, I'd argue maybe it's not a message at all.
No, it's information, but it's not. Yeah. I feel like a message needs intent to be a message.
Yeah, I agree. Okay.
The tree is not trying to tell us anything.
Yeah. But so the whole context thing, it's really interesting to me because it's part of the reason that scientists took so long to recognize intelligence in other animals. And yeah, so I think if we're going to ground ourselves in reality with it, the big question that affects a lot of our mental health and that is the fact that we're now bombarded with information without meaning a lot of the time. And we probably could get meaning, but we don't have time to. And that's kind of an interesting one that they didn't have the 20 years ago, I think. I mean, you did to an extent. If you wanted to buy all the newspapers, you'd probably have a similar effect, but nobody outside of doing it for their job, would buy all the newspapers and sit there and read them going, oh no, there are so many things. And that's what we do every day. Like, we wake up and scroll through Twitter.
And panic at all of the things.
Yeah. And, you know, misinterpret it, and you think you have context, but you don't. And in that case, is it meaningful or is it just information? And, oh, I'm giving myself a bit of a fucking, it's not even an existential crisis at this point, just a crisis.
Yeah, I think you're just going to spiral downward here.
Yeah. So I bring it back to the comfortable, which is nice things, information without context, like when you're a kid and you are listening to conversation, you don't understand coming from downstairs. That's always nice.
Yeah, it's just like sort of a pleasant burble of words.
Yeah, and asemic writing. Asemic writing. Which I like, which is like a message, but the message is that it means nothing. So it's that, just for listeners, it's that abstract kind of writing.
So it looks like it is writing, but it's completely meaningless.
Yeah.
Didn't you buy a whole book of asemic writing? A
couple of them, yeah. There's the codex that I wanted. I've forgotten the name of it. I wasn't able to get hold of because the copy I found, like, the eBay seller cancelled it. But I will get hold of it one day, and I will link to something about it.
I do like in the sort of chapter where they're talking about what gives information meaning, when they use the jukebox analogy, they mention pointers, which is something I obviously had to learn how they worked when I was studying C++, and that was one of those. I absolutely cannot get my head around this concept for weeks until I had to use it in a practical context.
Can you explain to me the context you'd use them in C++?
I'm not great at explaining it, so proper programming listeners, don't all write in to correct me, but you can. The idea is, if you use a pointer, it's a variable, but instead of it holding a piece of information, it points to a piece of information in memory. Mm-hmm. So bearing in mind the main context I was using them in was in games, and what it meant was that you could call a function and it wouldn't have, rather than having something, say, a character.
Yeah.
Like a player character. Rather than having to load that player character every time, say, these functions are being called, it has a pointer instead of a variable for the player character. So it's not loading it, it's just going to that bit in memory and looking at it.
Okay, yeah, I think I know what you mean. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, cool.
So, knowing how they work obviously is very handy for making games, but it took a long time for me to get my head around why I was using these things.
Is this the one you told me where you were like, oh, I see, because otherwise the game would be computer-breakingly big immediately?
Yes, this is what we were talking about. Coffee. They're also kind of scary when you first use them, because it's like, oh, you're pointing to this thing in memory and maybe you could accidentally just remove some of your memory, maybe.
Oh, no.
It's not that bad.
Yeah.
But you don't want to let them dangle.
Oh, I would never.
Never let your pointers dangle. Anyway, going on to the actual book, and not my bollocks trying to remember stuff I learned last year.
Sure.
The whole kind of theme of how the wizards win the day is this idea of knowledge in unbelief and seeing being disbelieving.
Mm-hmm.
And I like it because you have Discworld as such a solid example of this, especially if you look at something like Hogfather, but it's obviously brought up here where Ridcully is arguing with the Queen and says, yeah, we've got bogeymen outside where we can get at them. And that's Susan's frustration that, like, yeah, these things are real.
Yeah.
But now I've got to fight them off because the children are annoyed at them because they've learned to be scared of them rather than just learning how to hit them.
Yes, yeah.
And this is, they talk about this idea of when the Queen's confronting Rincewind and she's saying, why are you doing this? She's saying, isn't it what you want? We can fill them with wild imagination. And as it goes into the scientific side of it, it builds in these ideas of the difference between seeing and believing, and that if you become used to something, you no longer believe in it because you don't need to. You don't have to have faith in it. It's just there. It talks about this idea of ontic dumping knowledge into a name.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you can dump knowledge into something, but then you have the etymology of that of this word, and that's what carries the history of it.
Yeah.
And the gossamer is such a great example of it, that it, yes, you can hear gossamer and you know what it means, but you don't necessarily know unless you look at it, the story of gossamer, that it means goose summer.
It's such a nice etymology.
Which is one of my very favourite etymologies.
An interesting, like, negative space version of that is what you were telling me fucking ages ago now about bears, right? A bear that doesn't mean the word bear, it means the word brown.
Yes, it's like the brown one, because you don't want to say the name of the bear, because that'll make the bear turn up.
Yes. And that's the same thing as the fairies, which would probably be the more relevant example for this book, obviously. Yeah. But the
Don't mention the fairies.
But Irish mythology has all that stuff in, which it is does. Cool.
There was a really cool You're Dead to Me episode on medieval Irish folklore the other day, which we will link to in the show notes.
Yeah, just I really wanted an excuse to link that in the show notes.
I swear to God that someone involved with You're Dead to Me is listening to this podcast, because there just keeps being episodes that are relevant to what we're talking about.
Absolutely. I could have done with it before I did the fucking Vanishing Islands thing as well. Like, yeah, the experts on there casually mentioned a couple of things I couldn't dig up for the life of me when I was looking into some of the...
Anyway.
Sorry. Yeah, fuck. I'm taking us on a bear detour. The worst kind of detour.
Oh, mate, it was a bear detour, you know what I mean?
Oh, no.
That was the worst thing I've ever done. I'm so sorry. Okay, so... Memes are also talked about in this, which is another thing that really dates the book. And it is talking about memes in exactly the context they were understood in 2002. Mm-hmm. I remember reading the Richard Dawkins stuff about it, not in 2002 because I was like 10, but a bit later when I was a smug atheist philosophy wanker. And it's really interesting reading about it in the original context, this idea of the idea of memes being their ideas that spread effectively. But speaking of being a smug atheist and philosophy wanker, there were some hints of smug atheism in this.
Did you think so? You told me that before I like read it, and I was looking out for the real smug bits. Which did you think were?
It wasn't super smug, but I feel like I'm hyper alert to it because I know it's what I used to be like, and I know I was a bit of a dick with it. Mm. Which, you know, I became an atheist at Catholic school. I overcorrected. I'm not that way. I'm still an atheist, but I'm not like a dickhead. There's sort of some of it comes from good ideas, these ideas of, you know, reification can damage your philosophy if you start to believe in something too much, which is the scientist with the horse experiment. That's that example. You know, he's reified this philosopher, and so then when he does disprove it, it becomes this horrible tragic thing. There's lines like, oh, if you are religious and you want to feel comfortable about what we're saying, you can always assume that we're talking about all the other religions, but not yours.
Oh, yeah, no, that's it, yeah.
Which feels a bit like sort of passing stuff on the head.
Very 2002.
It is very 2002 atheism.
Yeah, to be fair, that chapter was a bit worse. The first one they did around religion, I thought was unusually fair-minded about, I think they said... It, you know, there were bits about, and some people believe this and some people believe this, and religion's done this good and this bad, and you know, most individual priests might be good, but as a whole, you know, the Inquisition happened and this, that, and the other. But yes, no, the later bit in the book, yes, you're right, it's a bit more Dawkinsy.
Yeah, and they talk about altruism and the potential religious origins of it, but that obviously altruism comes from more than just religion. We don't need religion to be good, which is very much not the argument of a smug atheist, but the argument of an atheist is I don't need Beardy Man in the Sky to tell me to be good, to just be nice. Because I've learned to do that on my own. I mean, nice is a strong word for how I am as a person.
Altruistic, Francine, I think you are. That's fair.
Vaguely.
No, I can't verify. You're always nice to me.
Good point.
Other people, fuck them. Wait, no, that's not right. Other people, important. I know that without God.
And they talk about science overturning belief, and they talk about the failings of religion. And I do respect talking about the failings of religion, especially, as you said, they talk about the Inquisition and religious conflict. There's this line, the only safe home for one's personal spirituality is oneself, which I don't totally disagree with. But then you compare it to, obviously, the science stuff, and this is a science book. I really like, really early on, they talk about the idea of defining science, and they use this example of how do you define a chair? When does a chair become a chair? I really fucking love that they use this example, because I don't know if you know about Glinner and the horse thing.
No.
Oh, this was ages ago, but it was very, like, you know who Glinner is?
The
transphobic dude.
Yeah. Twitter maniac.
Yeah.
Graham Lynham.
Yes. And he... went on this whole rant about this is the only way you can define a woman and this chromosome, blah, blah, blah. And someone was like, how do you define a chair? And so he gave this really specific definition that also covers horses. So someone sent back a picture of a horse and said, behold a chair.
Someone just did Diogenes again on Twitter, for goodness sake.
This is quite old now, yeah. But it gets sent to him a lot.
I like that.
And I think we should all Diogenes a bit more.
Yeah.
Except every time I cook a chicken at home, I take it out of the packet and wave it around going, behold a man. And the joke's gotten old. I do it when I'm on my own.
Oh, can the joke get old on your own?
Yeah, but I still can't not do it.
Oh, that's a shame.
So they talk about the story inherent in scientific method. They talk about big changes and, you know, the way that we've grown to expect much more and more changes within our lifetimes. Still don't have hover cars. I'm still kind of bugged about that.
Yeah.
I know we should all be taking the train instead and that's better for the environment, but like hover trains.
Yeah, sure. Whatever. Just make sure it hovers.
Yeah.
Come
just
on.
Want more shit to hover.
We're not hover horse. Fine.
Yeah. I'll accept a hover horse and car.
Hover Segway. I don't care. Just want to hover. Okay.
Unicorns. Why has science not made unicorns yet? No, that's a whole other thing.
Don't give it ideas. You've read the Island of Dr. Moreau. That's just calm down.
Anyway, and the kind of conclusion they come to in the Science of Discworld collection bit is this: stories begin to choke the system, but seeing is not believing. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that. I love this idea. They talk about religion as an idea, as a story to help us cope with the size of the universe. And they talk about science. It is a similar thing. It's stories we tell ourselves because we can't actually comprehend it all in one go because there's a lot and it's too big and it's also too small at the same time.
Yeah.
The thing with science is stories we tell ourselves, but as science adjusts with new knowledge and new testing and new proofs of things that mean that things we thought were fact are no longer fact because this is fact, modern perception of and modern stories don't keep up with it.
Yeah.
So actually, you know, transphobes and Graham Linehan and talking about XX chromosomes are a really fucking good example.
It's just fucking science.
Yeah, we're taught in, like, I don't know, middle school biology or whatever, that one has XX chromosome and one has XY chromosome, and that's how it works, and that's man and that's woman. And then science has very much proven that it's all a lot more complicated than that, and also, you know, gender and sex are two different things. But the transphobes will come back to that middle school biology from the 90s and say, no, but it's fucking science, isn't it?
Same goes with, like, fat phobia. Calories in, yeah. Calories out.
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
But how about the incredibly complicated human? But no, it's science. Okay, you don't want to do actual science. Fine.
Fucking BMI, which is accepted as science, not just like by dickheads on Twitter, but by the medical community. It still uses a metric by the NHS. It's still used to define obesity, which is used to be medically fatphobic in all sorts of ways, including denying people healthcare, denying people health insurance based on their BMI, which has been thoroughly proven by science to be based on some really junk studies.
Yeah, and even if it wasn't, was never meant to be used on an individual level.
No.
It's meant to be a population-wide statistic. Yeah.
Anyway, my point is,
I accidentally shook us off on it.
No, I was very much in that rant. Seeing is absolutely not believing, but there is a limit to how much faith can be put in science if you're not willing to stop believing and only see. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The things like that, there are some science things I think about this sometimes, about how much do I actually know. When I think I don't have faith, I can't believe in God, whatever.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I have enough faith in the kind of framework of science, as nebulous as that might be in my head, to tell me that we go around the sun.
Yeah.
To use a real basic example. I was like, yeah, sure, I believe you. That seems right. I'll never see it with my eyes, probably.
I've not checked.
That might be a bad example because, you know, the whatever, you can see a certain amount of stuff from telescopes, whatever's. But there are definite things that I would never be able to see and check myself.
Yeah,
many things that I just take on faith, I suppose, or trust. Take on trust, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think it's absolutely fine to have faith and trust in science. Obviously, I'm not recommending that we burn all the scientists and give up vaccines.
No, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's just interesting to think about trusting other people to see for you, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how much of it is really faith? We're not seeing it. We are believing it more than we're seeing it.
Yeah.
Which comes back slightly to our theme last week of talking about this critical thinking idea.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to statistics that are somewhat and scientific studies. There's, you know, looking at, science has proven this, and you're mm-hmm. missing the sort of giant brackets that say in mice.
Yes. Oh my God, fucking, yeah. Don't get either of us started on science junk reporting.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have a giant overarching point. I like the book and I like that as a theme, but if this has not been my favourite.
No, I can't even say I like the book, to be honest, but
I really like the story.
I found some interesting bits in it.
Yeah, I liked the story and it did make me think.
I enjoyed reading the bits about the wizards. And I liked Terry Pratchett bits, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, weirdly, on this Discord and podcast, we quite parts, like...
Yeah, there were parts of the science bit that I found interesting and
yes,
illuminating, and others that I found not.
Have you got an obscure reference finial for me, Francine?
I do.
Amazing.
Winkin the glove stitcher and Costa the apple seller discuss mm-hmm. the play on the way home. Costa is short for costermonger, which is a street seller of fruit and vegetables in British towns. So that's mm-hmm. that. Costa the apple seller. And Winkin, tiny bit of a stretch here, but I'm pretty sure I'm on the right track. Winkin spelt with an E instead of an I, second I, so W-I-N-K-E-N, means wave in German. He's the glove stitcher.
Oh.
Yeah, I reckon.
Also, I'm pretty sure Shakespeare's father made gloves.
Did he now?
Yeah.
Ooh.
They're extra.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Cool. Things.
Not very in-depth obscure reference, because as last time we did Science of Discworld, most of the references are explained in depth in the next chapter. So
it's very hard to find something goes unexplained. Okay, well, I think that's everything that we are going to say about the Science of Discworld Volume 2, The Globe. As previously mentioned in a bonus episode, we are going on our summer holidays and taking a slightly longer break than we usually do because life, and I've got to finish writing a book.
Yeah, guys, that one.
That's happening. So we will be back as soon as we can after the 28th of July to talk about Good Omens.
Yeah.
Season 2. There might be some bonus stuff from us in the meantime. Keep an eye on the feed.
If you really miss us, you can always join the Patreon.
We will still be doing episodes on the Patreon. Rabbit holes abound. But until, if you are just going to abandon us until we come back and talk about Good Omens Season 2.
Which seems fair, to be honest.
Yeah, that's fine. In the meantime, dear listener, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, because it helps other people find us. Say nice things about us, because we really like praise. You can also... follow us on Instagram at The True Show Make You Fret, on Twitter at Make You Fret Pod, on Facebook at The True Show Make You Fret. Join our subreddit community, r/TTSMYF. Email us your thoughts, queries, castles, snacks, and angled lawns, thetrueshowmakeyoufretpod@gmail.com. As we said, if you want to support us financially and get some fun bonus nonsense, go to patreon.com/thetrueshowmakeyoufret and give us some money.
Yay.
And until next time, dear listener, if we shadows have offended, think but this, and all is mended, that you have but slumbered here whilst these visions did appear, and this weak and idle theme no more yielding but a dream. Gentles, do not reprehend. If you pardon, we will mend. And as I am an honest puck, if we have an earned luck, now to scape the serpent's tongue, we will make amends ere long, else the puck a liar call. So, good night unto you all. Give me your hands, if we be friends, and Robin shall restore amends.
Was that the end of this book?
That's the end of Midsummer Night's Dream.